I wanted to do another kind of contextual talk. And in this case, what I wanted to do was put Zen in context. And I don't remember why I wanted to do that. For some reason, I had some thought that, this is a question for some people. Anyway, so that's what I planned on doing, so that's what we're going to do, whether it's the right thing to do or not, because I can't do anything else except what I was thinking about doing. I'll probably edit that out of the... So, when Lhotse Rinpoche named this undertaking, he called it, one of the two things he called it was... a place for finding the path to liberation. And path is a very common term in Buddhism, but not very common actually in Zen, because the Zen view is that you just have to wake up to your true nature or your Buddha nature, which is already there. So there's obviously no path to waking up to what's already there, because you have no place to go. The path implies you're going from one place to another place, which is unique in Zen to frame things that way, although there's nothing completely unique in the Buddhist teaching about Zen, just sort of the way that it's framed. In every other Buddhist tradition, the idea of the path is very important, which is to say that you are someplace and you want to go someplace. That where you are is, for whatever reason, not satisfactory. And the path is what gets you to the place that's satisfactory. And the path is a set of practices. I think that the path as a metaphor sometimes creates some problems for Westerners, because I think we imagine ourselves as something that's on a path going to a place. That's sort of the image. But actually, we are the path ourselves. And what we do when we practice is we cultivate ourselves. We cultivate the path aspect of ourselves, if you will. And the general tradition that developed in India as time went on and as the monasteries developed and became more like what we would call universities, the general tradition that developed was to understand the path in a very systematic and sequential and graded way. So by the time Buddhism reached its peak in India in the 11th century, and then shortly thereafter disappeared because of absorption by Hindu traditions and destruction of monasteries by Muslim invaders. The Buddhists had articulated the path in great detail, and they literally had created what I sometimes consider like a cookbook or an instructional manual, so that what they laid out was, here's where you start. These are the practices that you adopt to cultivate yourself. And if you do them in the recommended way, you get to the end of the path, or you perfect yourself and you become a Buddha. I mean, it's kind of like a computer repair manual or a car repair manual, if you will, literally. I mean, if you want to think of it in that language, it's laid out in that way. And everything that you would need to know to get from ordinary to enlightened is there. Now, that particular tradition was taken on by the Tibetans, and that's how it's come down to us. It's come down to us through the Tibetans because they absorbed the monastic, the Indian monastic tradition. Off and on here, I've talked about the three principal aspects of the path, of and which are, in shorthand, renunciation, altruism, and wisdom. But those don't represent the whole path. They represent sort of the foundation. And then there's another element of the path that builds on the foundation, and that's the Vajrayana practices, or the visualization practices that we do, which have two aspects. The first aspect, and this kind of visualization practice, is something one does after one understands or has developed some facility with the basic elements of the path, which is to say one has cultivated some wisdom, some altruism, and some renunciation. There are two aspects of the Vajrayana or the tantric path, and one is called creation stage, and the other is called completion stage. And the practices that we do with visualization, with images, are the creation stage practices in which you create yourself as a Buddha. The completion stage practices are practices that are associated with direct control of inner energies. And I remember I've talked about this metaphor of the horse and the rider, where Buddhists understand the mind as having sort of an awareness aspect and an energetic aspect. Horse and rider, the awareness aspect rides, is like the rider on the horse, which is the energy. The awareness aspect directs inner energies. Libido, for example, the Freudian concept of libido would fit this idea of inner energies. Qi in Tai Chi, or Pran in yoga, all refers to the same thing. So the creation stage practices are about organizing the mind, stabilizing the mind by using images. And what those images do is they have an impact on the inner energy. The completion stage practices are about working with those energies directly. And the idea is to so harness the energies as to concentrate the mind very fully, so the mind doesn't wander. So in the creation stage practices, when you're working with images, you'll see how your mind wanders. But as you begin to develop some facility with holding it in place and contemplating the images, then you begin to notice how actually your inner energy, your inner vitality, your inner awareness stabilizes, becomes brighter, clearer, and stronger. And when you begin to experience that, that's a sign that you're verging on to doing completion stage practices, that you have the ability to work with the energies directly. Because you can begin to perceive them based upon your ability to control your mind through the use of images. When you get to the place where you can actually work directly with the energies of the mind, then you can go to the last stage, which has different kinds of names in different Buddhist traditions, but it's the equivalent to Zen practice, which is to say it's contemplating the nature, the actual nature of mind itself, and there are consequences to that. So if you've seen the movie Blessings, and this is the inspiration for this particular talk, if you've seen the movie Blessings, which is shown here, there's a place in the movie where all the pilgrims have this opportunity to meet with this very ancient yogini living in a house someplace off the beaten track. And all the nuns are saying, oh yeah, well, she's enlightened. She's an enlightened person. And it would be very good to go see her. And so they go see her, and she says, well, I don't know anything in particular, but when I was younger, I was practicing very, very vigorously. And at a certain point, and this is the way it's translated in the movie, I realized the nature of mind. And from that point on, I was freed. So what does that mean? Well, realizing the nature of mind is an extraordinarily difficult task. And what the completion stage practices do by controlling the energies is they so concentrate the mind that it doesn't waver. And then you can turn the attention that's been concentrated on the nature of mind itself. And then you can realize what mind actually is. That's the culmination of the Buddhist path, is to realize what mind actually is. Now, you think, well, how can that be the culmination of the path? Because we start the path talking about mind training. Well, when we start the path and we talk about mind training, such as developing wisdom and altruism and renunciation, because mind training really is what the path is, we think we know what we're doing because we think we know what our minds are. But in fact, we don't really know what our minds are. Because, at least as the Buddhists describe mind, it doesn't have any characteristics. It's something which knows, it cognizes, it's luminous, they say, but it's not tangible. You can't grasp it, you can't point to it, you can't weigh it, you can't measure it. It completely eludes any scientific approach. And if you ask people, if you ask different people about what the nature of their minds is, you get different answers. I mean, there's seven of us in this room, and if we all had kind of a blue book exam, you know, and it had one question, you know, in 500 words or more, or less, whichever the case may be, whatever you like, describe the nature of mind, you could be sure that we'd have seven different utterly irreconcilable, for the most part, descriptions of what is the nature of mind. We wouldn't agree on what it is, really. So when we don't think about it too seriously, we're all sure that we agree on what it is. But if we really got down to trying to define what it is and how it works and so on and so forth, we'd discover that we don't agree. And if you try and look at your mind, even as you yourself define it, seven different definitions, you'll find it extremely difficult to find it. If you try and find what is it, for example, if you were to define the mind as that which knows, that's not a bad definition for the mind, that which knows, that which cognizes. If you sat still for a while and you tried to find that part of yourself which does the cognizing or knowing, you would have an extremely difficult time doing that. Maybe that's a homework assignment when you go home. Try to find the part of you that does the cognizing and watch it. And you will have a very hard time keeping your attention on what you think is doing the cognizing. And if you do that, what you'll find probably is that you're paying attention to something that's thinking or thoughts. But thoughts aren't doing the cognizing. That's not the mind. And if you think, okay, well, the mind is that which is aware, so I'm going to pay attention to awareness. I'm not going to pay any attention to thoughts. If you really try to pay attention to your own awareness for a long time, you start noticing that you have a problem, for example, which is awareness is paying attention to awareness. So which awareness is actually the mind? The one that's paying attention or the one that's being attended to? That's a hard one to deal with, because they're not the same thing. But the one that you're paying attention to was the one that was paying attention to everything else before you paid attention to it. And you get yourself into all of these like complicated situations. And then if you turn off the thought process entirely, so you can just watch what's going on, you'll probably fall asleep. And so you still won't find the nature of mind. So without belaboring this point, if you get actually serious about the idea of finding the nature of the mind, you'll find it extremely slippery, hard to identify, in fact, pretty much impossible for most people to get at. I've asked this question of undergraduate students, and it drives them berserk when they finally figure out what I'm asking them, because they can't get at it. It makes them unhappy. But anyway, it is an actual achievement to get at cognizing or becoming aware of mind. Okay, but becoming aware of mind and becoming aware of the nature of mind aren't even the same thing. So I was kind of sloppy in the way I was first talking about this. But being aware of mind and being aware of the nature of mind are two different things. Because if you really get it down to the place where you can see your mind, that doesn't mean you understand its nature. It just means you're seeing it. So how do you understand its nature? Well, I'm not even going to try and answer that question. My whole point is to say that there is this kind of sequence of things that's going on. So the Zen tradition is basically all about that last thing, which is looking into the nature of mind, finding the Buddha nature within yourself, finding the Buddha mind within yourself. And if you find that, then there's nothing else to do. And in the Zen tradition, they say you just sit still and don't do it. Don't do anything. When anything comes up, you just let it go. You know, thoughts come up, you just let them go. Feelings come up, you just let them go. And you go back to what? Being aware. So I'm not going to do a long talk about what is the nature of Zen or how does that work or not work or anything like that. But I did want to take the time to kind of create this context. And as I said, I don't remember why I felt like I wanted to do that. I did want to talk about ascertaining the nature of mind or discovering the nature of mind because of that comment in the movie. You know, that when this nun did so, then she was finished. She'd become a Buddha. She didn't look like a Buddha. She didn't have a bump on her head or anything. But she was a Buddha. There wasn't anything else. And the nuns recognized that that was the case. I think one of the things that's interesting for us is that, especially because we're practicing with images, we have this idea of what Buddhas look like, right? Because we have this template, you know, Buddha has a bump on his head and long ears and is luminous, has a beautiful body, certain age, and all this kind of nice stuff. But that's the template. That's the image that you visualize in the creation stage practice, and it serves a certain purpose in terms of stabilizing the mind and orienting you in a certain way. But of course, that's not what Buddhas look like. And since this nun was clearly a Buddha because she'd realized the nature of mind, she didn't look that way. For one thing, she was a she. For another thing, she was very old. For another thing, she didn't have many teeth. She couldn't sit up straight. But if you looked at her really closely in the movie, you'll actually see that she's not in the slightest an ordinary person. There's no question about the fact that she's not an ordinary person. All you have to do is watch her face and watch her eyes and watch her general demeanor. And if you can, see her mind. You can sort of see her mind kind of extended around her body or through her body. And you'll see that something different is happening. So, that's it for tonight. Yeah, questions, sure.
If one, for example, this woman achieves that, or gets to that place, I would expect them, again, what are expectations, but I would think she would have much to teach, that she would speak and work with people. And from what we saw in the movie, it didn't look like that's what she intended to do or did. I mean, these people came, they wanted to hear from her, and maybe just standing in her presence. I didn't see all the things you did. I saw an older person who looked, you know, wise and at peace. I was waiting for her to say something that would come out of getting to the place where she was a Buddha.
Actually, I thought she said a lot.
It was the one at the end he's talking about, not the one, not the yogini that was up in the...
Oh, I thought you were talking about the one up in the mountain.
No, the one at the end.
Let's see, what was she doing?
She was spinning a prayer wheel the whole time.
She was spinning a prayer wheel.
Oh!
Yeah, that's the one.
Okay, what... can you refresh my memory? What did she say? I remember saying some things, and I didn't think they were earth-shaking, but...
Well, that's okay.
Oh, it's absolutely okay. I just want to know what it means.
I don't remember exactly what she said, quite honestly.
Well, first she talked about the experience itself, which was that she was meditating in retreat and that a Dakini appeared to her and gave her some teaching and then came to the crown of her head and transformed into this teacher in that tradition, which I was not familiar mm-hmm. with, but it was Sangha. And then, like Padmasambhava or some great teacher, came to the crown of her head and then dissolved into her. And she said at that point, she realized the nature of mind mm-hmm. and that she cried and cried and cried. And from that point forward, that she said she, and this is probably the important part, that maybe the significance of it's not apparent, that she said since that time, you know, she's lived many years and that she's had her ups and her downs and, you know, the suffering, you know, things that there's been suffering, I don't remember the exact words, but that there's been suffering and that there's been good times. And that basically every moment that she spends constantly dedicating everything for the benefit of all sentient beings, that not a moment passes that she's not doing that. It's constant. No matter what else she's doing, chopping wood, carrying water, giving teachings, because she was the one that gives teachings to all those nuns. She's been their teacher since that time. So I don't know. They didn't say when it was exactly. Maybe 40 or 50 years. So she's been giving teachings all those times. But no matter what she's doing, else she's doing, that at the same time, she's constantly sending out, that's where her mind is. Mm-hmm. It's for the benefit of all sentient beings. And when Tenzin Palmo came in there and did a little, said something, uh-huh. you know, what she was saying was that if you could see what was there, that you would see, you know, probably see unimpeded mind or unimpeded light, you know, constantly emanating from her and touching everything, working constantly for the sake of all sentient beings. Mm-hmm. So that's the important part, and it's something that's very hard to talk about. It's very hard to comprehend what on earth that could mean when you say that for every second, you know, that your mind is turned in that direction. It's not turned in any other direction, that it's always basically working for the sake of all sentient beings. I mean,
sending out positive...
How it works, I don't know, because I'm not a Buddha, and that's the part that's the mystery and that's very hard to contemplate. I mean, when we're in the doing creation stage practice, we're visualizing what it might be like when we've arisen as Green Tara or Buddha, and we're sending out lights from our heart to help all sentient beings. We're in our mind, just like we're creating the image of what, or the template for what, as David said, for what the Buddha might be like, we're also creating a template for what those activities might be like. And so in our mind, you know, a rational, everyday mind, the way we can visualize that is through sending out light and bringing mm-hmm. back and thinking, you know, enlarging our mind and our space to think about all sentient beings and that we're... And when we say our intention initially, we're also doing that. We're saying that when we sit down to do this practice, we're intending to do what she's doing, which is for every moment of our life, doing nothing but engaging in benefit for all sentient beings. So it's very subtle and it's very hard to understand. And, you know, the fact that, you know, she's stayed here in a physical form. It's different than when coming in as a Buddha. I think lots of times the signs and the marks they talk about for a Buddha, for one thing, those are things that aren't, they're on a subtle realm that you don't necessarily see. So she would have those marks if you were a realized enough being bodhisattva on the path, like our teachers probably could look at her and see the subtle signs and marks of Buddhahood. But as ordinary people, we can't necessarily see them, except like David said, if you saw, I don't know if you saw her eyes at the end when they came in really close.
Mm-hmm.
Her eyes are like nothing else, like, you know, they're like nothing you see in ordinary beings. Mm-hmm. So she was giving probably the most complicated teaching there in just a few words, but it's very hard to, you know, for us to comprehend what that actually, you know, might mean or might be like. What would that be like to be able to have your mind be unimpeded and basically omniscient? You know, they say that's one of the signs of Buddhahood too, is you basically, your mind is unimpeded and it's omniscient. So you can, when you direct it, you can see somebody's, you know, like, you know, if you look at Brian, and I could see all his lives back to the beginning. You know, there's no beginning in time, beginningless time. See his, you know, and see what has come forward to create the Brian that's here right now in this moment. And because of that, be able to, like if Brian came to the Shakyamuni Buddha asking advice, Shakyamuni Buddha could look at him and see that all in that, in the Brian that's right there in front of him, so that he could give him, you know, advice on the path that nobody else, you know, could possibly give, because we're all coming from our habit patterns of mind and our projections and what we perceive, you know. We're not coming from that place of just being able to see in that way.
And we cognize everything through the vehicle of thoughts. We understand everything through the vehicle of our thoughts, which are limited by culture, language, they're dualistic, limited by our own capacity for understanding. But this type of person doesn't understand things that way.
Mm-hmm.
They understand things by perceiving them directly as what they are, not not looking at them as defined in a limited way by a certain kind of language, although obviously they can use language, but they can see what's actually what's actually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of like, I can't even think of a metaphor for this.
But it's like the wisdom thing with the knife that strips everything away.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, because everything has been stripped away to the what's really there.
It would be kind of akin to the Christian idea of contemplation and mystics. Kind of
possibly.
Mystical, almost. I mean, there'd be some sort of analog there, I think.
Tell us what that means.
They talk about losing all relation with the everyday world. I mean, not that they're not living in it, but, you know, they just perceive everything directly. They'll use that language. Direct perception. I've heard of them actually looking at a person and saying somewhat the same thing.
Right.
Ah.
You know, looking right at somebody and just telling them, yeah, you know, I know about you, in fact, you know. But they're just a very direct, with nothing impeding you, right?
Right.
Yeah,
absolutely nothing getting in the way. No culture. As if there was no culture, no filters. All the filters are gone.
That's exactly, Well, then, yes, then it is the same thing.
You're very
kind. No boundaries.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know what it means to perceive without filters, because that's the only way we perceive. So,
but isn't that part of why we meditate, to try to gain space?
Yes.
From those all the restrictions that we and judgments and
conditioning.
That's right. But when you're asking this question, well, so what were her teachings? You know, it didn't seem like a big thing. It's, I mean, that's the cognitive, that's the rational part of your mind that wants some complex philosophical statement as a teaching, and then it's like, oh, okay, now, you know, I've got this teaching. Here's this philosophical structure, and that's a real teaching.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not...
Yeah, and going back to the Zen tradition, You know, lots of times when they had enlightenment flash, you know, what would come out would be almost some kind of like a nonsensical kind of statement, you know, that if you go and look back and look at the stories, the different koans, I can't think of it. The one I think about is the pointing at the moon, but
it
because it defies words or explanation. Mm-hmm. There, lots of times it's just an action, like in the Zen stories, there's a lot of that, you know, somebody, a teacher will ask a question and then the student will do something surprising, like, you know, pick up a board and break it, or point at the moon, or something like that, something that's not verbal even, and that will somehow reflect their realization. So it's very hard in words. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, that's okay. Yeah, I mean, but see, that is the problem, that we're bound by words, but we're on a path that is aiming to take us first from words to images, then from images directly to the energetic underpinnings of our existence, and then directly through that into the nature of that energetic underpinning itself, which, you know, I don't know how much sense that can possibly make. But, you know, that's what it is. I don't know what else to say.
Well, she couldn't have given any advice, because I'm pretty sure that you have to learn things one slice at a time.
That's true.
And everybody there was already doing what they were supposed to be doing. And she had, to me, practiced herself into a very difficult job. I mean, it doesn't sound very wonderful to be dedicating and having good times and bad times. I mean, if she had achieved constant bliss and felt like dispersing her bliss to everybody, then I could see that would be worth.
I don't know that what you're talking about is actually contradictory. Because, you know, when one talks about good times and bad times, we're not exactly sure what she's referring to. You know, she could be referring to, well, we had a winter without very much to eat and it was pretty damn cold. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, my mind was still absorbed and altruistic.
Oh, that was the part I forgot, that she said that too, that no matter what the case was, that was a really important part. Uh-huh. To forget that her mind remained stable. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Never fluctuated.
So, yeah, so, you know, I mean, so there's a snowstorm howling outside. Remember, we're at Tibet, 14,000 feet or something, right? You know, there's a snowstorm howling outside. There's no water in the shack. There's not a whole lot to eat. Those are hard times, right? But her mind is steady and it's contemplation of altruism, studying his contemplation of self. The springtime comes along. There's all this food that shows up and everything is wonderful. Her mind's still steady in the contemplation. It's like negative stuff happens in the sense of it's difficult for the body, so it's negative stuff that's happening. Positive stuff happens, which is nice for the body, but she has equanimity, that her mind is not affected, even though all that other stuff is still going on. It's not like that stuff isn't going on. She has a body. She's living in the world. She's got to pour water down her throat every day. You know, I mean, that sounded a little crude, but she has to drink water every day. She has to eat to keep her body alive. She has to deal with the cold, you know. But she still has equanimity through the whole thing. And as far as, you know, teachings are concerned, I mean, she talked about her enlightenment experience. I mean, how many people have you run across that said, well, I was meditating and this dakini showed up and came to the top of my head and turned into something else and then became absorbed to me and I experienced this beatific blah, blah, and then my mind has never been the same since. Met anybody that like that lately?
No.
That's pretty profound teaching.
Can only hope.
But, I mean, you know, I'm not, maybe that didn't come out right, but what I'm trying to say is that's pretty profound,
right?
You know, and so for somebody to talk about that and say, "Well, this is my enlightenment experience," it's like, oh, You know, I mean, there are not a lot of people on the planet who can say, this is my enlightenment experience. I mean, wow. And on top of all of that, I've run across a couple of lamas who I think were probably enlightened. And when I asked them about that, they said, pfft, I don't know anything. What are you talking
they
about?
They did the same thing as the yogini up in the hill did. That's not, they're actually not supposed, you know, it's rare. It's more rare to have somebody say that, to tell about their experience, because there's kind of this unwritten rule that if you do have those experiences, that you don't, because you don't talk about them, because they just, it builds up your ego, and your teachers, for sure, you know, they may see some of those signs along the path, a little bits of realization and stuff. They never pat you on the back and say, good job, this is, you know, you just reached the level 5 bodhisattva or something
and
that. It just doesn't happen. And so actually her stance was more...
unbelievably generous. That was very generous-minded for her to say that at all. You know, for example, most of the lamas, even if they're very highly attained, won't say anything. And if you think about this, it's like all their students are going to be running around saying, wow, my lama is like, you know, he's done this and he had that experience. How about your lama? You know, I mean, students do that kind of stuff. You know, it's like, yeah, mine's better than yours, you know. So they don't, the Dalai Lama starts all his really major discourses off by saying, well, I've only got a little bit of experience. I only know a little bit, but I'll tell you what I know. And, you know, everybody in the audience is sort of sitting there. My interpretation. Everybody in the audience is sort of sitting there saying, ha, 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 ha. He just says that because he's, you know, modesty is part of the path and we know it's not true. But actually, I think that he's telling the truth as he sees it, because his own realization is so vast that he knows how little he knows. Mm-hmm. Unlike us, whose realization is so tiny, we think we know so much.
No. Oppenheimer once said the hardest part was realizing there is so much and understanding so little. And the more you realize there is so much to learn, the more humbling it is and almost scary to realize how little you know. But we stay in small ponds, so we think we know a lot.
Right.
Shatters that. I wanted to ask you, Caleb, when you're talking about, or she was talking about, sending out constantly, all day long, would that be like the part of the practice in the Green Taro, where you say, and I do every day, may all sentient beings be happy and have the causes of happiness. Mm-hmm. May all sentient beings be free from the suffering and the cause of suffering. Mm-hmm. And then it ends with, may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment and detachment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you say that, depending on what was on the news the night before, my mind is flooded with images of Somalia or someplace like that. And there's much more to it than that, but I'm just saying, when we see powerful images, those they take form when you send something like that out. Are you saying that she was at a place where she could just send out that kind of energy all the time?
24/7.
Yeah. And when you're saying that in the practice, you're setting your intention that someday you hope that you'll be in that place where you can do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But in the meantime, you are sending something out.
Yes, you're practicing as a creation stage.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, with using your energy. And it's funny, too, because one of the things that had a huge impact on me, I realized, and on my practice just recently, was we were watching, I'm always bringing up quantum physics, but we were watching this NOVA program the other night, and they were talking about, you know, parallel universes, and how there could be whole universes, you know, like there's a wall of our perception right here, right with you. And for me, that was like the most wonderful thing to hear that again, because I thought, one of the things Tara Tulku told me was in sending out the lights, you know, I was always like, I think this is a Christian, my Christian upbringing speaking here, is that I was always sending it like out and kind of, you know, trying to send it out as far as I could out into space and the whole world and not and all sentient beings, but realizing that actually I didn't have to do that. That as soon as I created myself as a Buddha and put up the in the Mandala Palace and do that, that really I don't have to send my light out that far, really, because to go I'm already have created the doorway through that, you know, kind of to that parallel universe or one of them or several of them, mm-hmm. by arising as, you know, Yamataka or the Buddha or whatever, and that the light's going out, you know, I don't have to limit myself into those thoughts of thinking that I have to send it out so vast, mm-hmm. you know, I can just send it out little ways, you mm-hmm. know, and that everything is right here, you mm-hmm. know, within that space, and that as long as I cross through that door of perception, you know, into a more subtle, you know, realm, that just sending out the light a little bit, and that they're right there. They're right, you know, the Buddha's right here with me. I don't have to, and in me, I don't have to think about it as, you know, out there.
And one, you know, connecting a couple of things here, when you, Kayla, when you were describing what she was doing,
mm-hmm.
it wasn't so much like she was sending it out, but she was just acting and living in harmony with that, and that everything she did was in harmony with that.
Mm-hmm.
And that occurred to me that, like, you know, for somebody like me just starting out, it's like, just like you're saying, Lloyd, I mean, that's like, how do you start at that? Well, you visualize projecting that, sending it out.
Mm-hmm.
And when you said that, Kayla, I was thinking, wow, so like the advanced level of that is you don't so much, I'm getting the sense that this woman doesn't even need to think, I'm mm-hmm. sending this out. It's just
it's
like she's doing it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And she's doing it while she's cooking dinner, drinking,
right.
whatever she's doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, and that's pretty amazing. And I was also thinking, you know, when I was young, I read the book The Razor's Edge by Somerset Maugham, and this guy goes off, and he goes through World War I and everything. Anyway, he ends up going to India, and he goes up on this mountain, and he really studies spirituality. And at a certain point, the phrase that stuck with me is, it's easy to be a holy man on top of a mountain. Then he comes back into society and lives and tries to put that in practice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's the really advanced level, I would think, where you're able to like in the case of this woman, just to live in that space and
mm-hmm.
to keep have that weave through everything you do would be. And I wanted to ask, so do we, you know, like somebody like the Dalai Lama or the, you know, the other really high level
advanced,
you know, practitioners of Buddhism, is that a thought that they are operating on that kind of level? Like everything they're doing basically is in some way advancing the benefit of all sentient beings? That's like pretty constant?
Yeah, if they're Mahayana practitioners, then that is the space that they're in. When we first met Lhotse Rinpoche in 1993 or 4 or whatever, I remember coming out of the meeting and saying a few things to Kay, such as, our lives are going to be different from here on out. That was for sure true. I had no idea how different. But the other thing was, I said, he's like a mantra machine. It was clear to me that there was no moment where he wasn't breathing a mantra, which is to say that he was generating in each instant a sound whose qualities were to affect all the space around him in a positive way. That's another way of talking about sending something out. We talk about sending out light, but mantra is sound which pervades all space, and the nature of the sound has an impact on space. So if you're constantly resonating that sound unceasingly, you're constantly impacting all of that space unceasingly. And Loy, as you were talking about the prayer that you do every day, and you said, let me be free from attachment and detachment. Mm-hmm. So you think, well, I understand being free from attachment, but what is this being free from detachment? So, you know, if you achieve some realization, it's easy to go sit in a cave then. But that's not being free from detachment. That's being bound by detachment. Mm-hmm. And being free from detachment then is not staying on the mountain.
Right. And no, also there's
it means
cycles.
To be wherever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like the word unattaching. Because detach is cutting off, suppression, not facing, for
okay.
me. Mm-hmm. For me. But to unattach is a process of letting go of attachments.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And letting go of detachments.
Yes.
Because, you know, I mean, it would be easy for me to detach from caring about people, for example, or detach from,
well,
you know,
things get tough. That's a,
yeah,
that's a easy way to go.
Yeah, there you go. Sure. So I don't need to say
that
anymore. Yeah.
But also, in regards to the cycle of your practice, what we found is that, and it, I don't know if it was a plan, if we planned this, or it's just the way our life evolved, but continually what happened is that we would, you know, live our ordinary life, and then we'd go do a retreat, right? And then we would go back, you know, and sometimes it would be long one. Like one time we went to India and did a few retreats and, you know, came back, went to Green Gulch and did a long retreat, and then finally went back into, and we had a choice at that point. And if I was doing the I Ching at that point too, there was a choice. Well, okay, now do we continue to basically follow the path of the sage, as the I Ching calls it, or do we go out into the, you know, go out into the world to teach, or, you know, whatever we do, you know, design flowers or whatever we were doing at that time. And so each time it was like we almost had a choice at that point of whether to continue in one vein or another. But that just kept happening throughout all the years that we've been together, is that there's always been these cycles of kind of intense meditation, sometimes just 2 or 3 weeks, or sometimes just a week, and then you go back out and you practice it again, you know? And when you're, lots of times when you're leaving to go do that retreat, you don't know where you're going to go from there, you know, if you're going to be coming back to the world or you're going to be doing this and that. So I think that there's, you know, lots of, you know, if you kind of devote your life to practice in some way, that you will run into that there will be times where you're on the mountaintop and times when you're coming back in basically to practice what you realized, you know, however minute the realization might have been, to come back in and so that's one way to do it. But also it's just, you know, to just do it in everyday life. Do your meditation practice in the morning. That's the same cycle. You're on the mountain in the morning, and you're bringing it back down into your daily, weaving it into your daily life. So, but that's really good insights.
And I try to remind myself during my work day and other time, just interacting with people, just to try to have that as a motivation in the way I operate or I work or I live my life. And I find it like really helpful, and I don't always, and I often, most of the time, probably don't have the answer, but into like what's the right course of action here. Mm-hmm. But I find that if I allow that thought to kind of run through me when I'm dealing with a situation, it's like, well, you know, I really do want to project the benefit of all sentient beings in what I'm doing right now, just as a reminder. And I feel like this is pretty low level, but it's really helpful to me. And it's like, okay, well, that doesn't mean like all of a sudden this voice comes out of the sky and says, well, here's the right thing to do. But it, I find it helpful, and it's kind of subtle, but I feel like it informs the way I act in some of those situations, and I find it helpful. Mm-hmm. And so I think it'd be really cool to be at that level where you're just like there all the time. Just, you know, that sounds like you can get a lot done in a lot of great ways and do a lot of good things. Yeah. So in the meanwhile, I find it helpful in some situations.
Yeah. Anything else? Let's see if there's anything else? Nope.